I read Gerard Baker's History Repeats in Iran op-ed piece, quote, "It isn't unpatriotic to express skepticism about our ability to fight and win this kind of war." Of course, and I think that's an accurate statement since I've been listening to you for such a long time, spreading a dose of realism. It's easy to say we got the biggest military in the world, but when you look at the reality of even what happened yesterday, what do? We, well, did some defensive strikes, but we bombed missile sites and we bombed the boats and other these resources that apparently Iran has tons of, as you keep pointing out. And when you pivot over to the idea the Saudis have to contemplate this, if we can't resolve some sort of peace, which sounds like it's being discussed, they're going to get their desalination plants get hit. They're going to have their infrastructure get hit. They have enough resources, the Iranians do, to blow up lots and lots of really important targets. And I would say the desalination plants, that's a humanitarian problem for the Saudis. They're not going to have drinking water. So the realities of just saying we're going to fight and win, not as simple as you, Daniel Davis, have been pointing out now for quite some time. So where are we on this? Is it, do you think Donald Trump is willing to, like, not push for an unconditional surrender, but go ahead and agree to this, what sounds like the framework at least has been reached to open the ports back up, open the Strait of Hormuz back up, and then let's talk longer about the nuclear program. That's about what we've got this morning, although some sides are saying yes and some sides are saying no. And, of course, everything comes with the United States says, but Iranian officials deny kind of caveats to it. I know that's a lot to unpackage, Daniel, but we've got a lot to unpackage right now.
Yeah, and let's just start with the military aspect of it. This is absolutely an unwinnable military problem for the United States. It doesn't matter if you look at the spreadsheets of who's got more power on the other side. It is well overwhelmingly in our favor. Our budgeted last year was $1 trillion. Theirs was about $12 billion, I think, something like that. Just a fraction of ours. Of course, their stuff is antiquated. They don't have much of it, etc. But they have what is necessary to defend their country. Our military problem is so much greater than the Iranian military problem that it's hard to overstate, because you have geography. Not only is it a country that's about as big as Western Europe, but it's also got the entire Western, nearly half of the country is a massive series of mountain ranges, not just making it nearly effectively impossible to invade on a ground route, which is why we never even contemplated putting a ground force, but it also makes it nearly impossible to win in the air, because they have all these underground bunkers in granite mountains. And I've been inside one of our granite mountain complexes, which is designed to survive a nuclear blast when I was on active duty. And they're basically constructed the same way. So you're never going to get them off of there. So it doesn't matter how many missiles we have, because we can't penetrate in that far into the mountains. So they're going to maintain the ability to do, as you suggested a second ago, hit desalination plants, oil infrastructure, energy infrastructure, gas fields, you name it, if we restart this war. And that gives them tremendous negotiating leverage, and they very well know it. And so now then we're stuck with, what can President Trump do? We should, I of course argue we shouldn't have ever started this war, but we have. So now we have what we have. How then are we going to get out of it? Iran is saying, listen, we do want to negotiate a settlement. This blockade and the attacks from the first 40 days have genuinely caused a lot of harm and pain for the Iranian side. And they have a lot of motivation to get this off, but they don't want to have to come back and do this again 6 months from now, 9 months from now, whenever we're and Israel is ready to attack again from their perspective. So they say, listen, I want like at least $12 billion of my funds released up front, sanctions relief that are going to be phased in as we go through on negotiations. And then we have a two-phase process from the Iranian side. One is to get the strait opened up, which they say they'll do with caveats. They want the reprocessing, et cetera. And then once we get past that part, then we'll start talking about the negotiation for nuclear program, et cetera, which they say is on the table. So that's a positive thing. But that means President Trump has to do something that he's been mocking on Truth Social, which is Obama gave billions in cash to Ukraine or to Iran, et cetera, in the 2015 deal. But now Iran is saying, we've got to have even more of that before we'll even start negotiations on phase one. That is the big problem we face right now.
It really is. And all of this absent, you know, total regime change, you know, pivoting aside from whether, you know, they get some cash up front, which would be an embarrassment to, I think, everybody, or it the strait opens up and we let their ports open up first, which would help everybody to a large degree deal with this backup of shipping and everything. And then let's just say that happens, though. Is Donald Trump willing to get less than or take less than he's been promising in order to get himself out of these problems that we all are dealing with regard to the ripple effect in the economy? And I think more importantly, recognizing that absent regime change, which of course would require all the military complexities you just mentioned and so much more, the Iranians know that at any time on a going forward basis, they could close the Strait of Hormuz back down because they've done it before and they know they can do it again.
Well, that's exactly the point. And I think that they, in fact, they're saying this morning, we will never go back to the pre-war conditions. The Strait of Hormuz can be open and we'll have it completely open as long as everybody pays a fee. They say, yeah, it's not a toll. Let's be accurate. It's a fee. But whatever, they're saying, yeah, we will never relinquish control of this. So whatever agreement you think you're going to come up with America, it needs to include that or there's not going to be a deal on top of the money and everything else. And that's just what it's hard to imagine why they would ever go back on that with that leverage in their hand to just relinquish it with nothing but a word, a promise from our side, because our word hasn't been very good here in the last 2 years with the wars that we started in 25 and 26. So that's kind of where we're at also on the difficulty side. But for President Trump, he is really, I think, digging himself a deeper hole right now and making it more difficult because he keeps mocking stuff from the Obama deal in 2015. But he's going to have to do something that's kind of like it or he's not going to succeed. And his base is well aware of this. And in fact, I think it was this morning, Jack Keane was on there saying, do not make a deal, Mr. President. Don't do it because they wouldn't live up to it, et cetera. There's no trust on either side. But the problem is there's going to have to be, Brian, because if we don't, I'm tired of paying $95 for a tank of gas for Wascar. You know what I'm saying? And it's only going to get worse if we don't get this thing open with pretty quick.
Well, in speed of the 2015 deal, I mean, the Iranians can't be trusted either. They were supposed to limit their uranium production and they built more centrifuges and they pushed more toward getting a nuclear weapon. And Hans Blix would go in from time to time and give us some, you know, strongly worded letter and nothing would happen. And they just continued to go down their merry way, also while continuing to fund proxy terrorist organizations. So, you know, the regime is evil and bad. I think we can all collectively agree on that. But it doesn't sound like we can really accomplish anything. And oddly enough, they seem like they have the upper hand right now, Daniel Davis, which I think, could that be contemplated at the outset of this? I know you didn't want to launch this war at the outset, but is that something that you think the administration contemplated, that Iran would have an upper hand to this end?
They should have. I've spoken several times with Joe Kent after he resigned from the ODNI. And he confirmed to me that absolutely that the president was told by a number of people, senior intelligence, senior military people, they said the likelihood is that if you strike, they're going to take control of the Strait of Hormuz and they may never relinquish it. So he was told by other people, they said, nah, they won't do that or else we can take it from them. He listened to the people who told him what he wanted to hear, unfortunately. And so that's why we got in. Now, I would take a bit of an issue with the claim that Ukraine or that Iran, continued to break all their promises and reprocess, et cetera. They only did that after we got out of the deal. So when they were in the deal, they largely kept to it. And every time Hans Blix and some of these other folks would acknowledge some place they were out, they would bring it back into compliance until we left it. And even when they went up to 20% and then 60%, they said they would go back to the 3.67% if we would go back to the JCPOA. So there is that, and we, of course, would never do that once we started it. And now then again, we are where we are. Whether we should have been or shouldn't have been doesn't matter now. Yeah. This is where we are, and how are we going to get out of it?
Well, and one more point I want to ask you about, Daniel Davis, before we part coming today. The whole idea of getting the various Arab nations together under one big Abraham Accord, I love the idea. Conceptually, it's beautiful. Everybody can trade and play nicely with each other. Nobody's going to be dropping bombs on each other, and everybody gets to keep their own country. Fine. What's the likelihood that I know the Iranians would never accept peace with the Israel. They hate Israel. They want to eradicate them from the map. But the other Arab nations who haven't yet signed on to the Abraham Accords, are they going to give up their, you know, animosity, hatred toward the whole concept of Israel being there?
The Saudi Arabia is, that's kind of the linchpin, and that's what both Israel and the United States have been chasing after since the Abraham Accords were first announced. Saudi Arabia has always said they are open to the idea. They would be willing to if, and this is the big if, Israel recognizes a Palestinian state in Gaza and in the West Bank and gives freedom to the people. They said that's our non-negotiable requirement, and then we want to, and then others would fall in place. There is a deal to be had there. There is an expansion of the Abraham Accords, which could bring a lot of peace to the region, but it comes with, for what right now is the Israeli political poison pill, of having anything to do with a Palestinian state. They won't even contemplate that. So that is dead on arrival, because Saudi Arabia is emphatic that they will not compromise on that point. There's other things that they can work with, and they desire it overall, but they won't compromise on that. And right now, Israel won't either. So the whole thing is dead.
So if the Saudi proposal were to go through, and I know how much of an ask that is, you establish a Palestinian state in the regions you talked about, Saudi Arabia, they come over to the idea of Abraham Accords. Does that bring with them the various other Arab nations? Does that concession by the part on the Israeli part work for all the other countries, presumably with the exception of the Iranians?
No, I think it does. I think that most other countries also want that as well. They would love to live in peace. And man, all these GCC countries that have been hit this war, they want nothing more than for all the reasons for war to be off the table so they can just do business, sell oil, get money from it, and take care of their population. They would love that. But that's a pretty big problem that so far has never been solved.
And I presume that Hezbollah would then therefore forward from that point forward be defunded. Hezbollah wouldn't get what it wants with the eradication of Israel, but all the other countries probably would stop funding the terrorist
except
network.
That, and this is not commonly thought about here, but both Hamas and especially Hezbollah and the Houthis, they are both on record as saying they are fighting because of what's happening with the Palestinians in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. If that gets solved, and the Houthis have shown they've done this, when Israel has done what it said on the ceasefires or whatever, they backed off. So there is every reason to think that the Hezbollah would also back off, because they also don't want to catch Israeli missiles and tank rounds in the teeth every time something happens. They'd love to not have to do that anymore. So it has a lot of positive ripple effects if we could get there.
We'll find out someday. Daniel Davis Deep Dive every Tuesday here on the 55 KRC Morning Show at 8:30. Find him during the week and all the conversations he has with others. Thank you for your time, as always, Daniel Davis.
Always my pleasure, Brian. See you next time.
Enjoy your week. 842, 55 KRC, the talk station. We're going to learn about medical insurance and how to get it cheaper. John Ruhlman coming up next. Don't go away.
This is 55 KRC, an iHeartRadio station.